Welcome back to On Air.
Joining us on air this week is Patrick Johnston, Canucks reporter from the province and the Vancouver Sun. Hello, Patrick. Thanks for taking the time to do this on a sunny Saturday. Stanley Cup playoffs are starting, but the Canucks have a game today that is not playoff related. How about that?
Or outside. I get none of this. I have to deal with the churn of the last four games, or at least two of the last four games of the season. I'll live. It's tough. It's a tough life. You know, it's a tough job I have, and I'll manage to do it somehow.
Well, it's been certainly a very active week for the Canucks, probably more so off the ice. It seems like we're headed to a place where something's going to come to pass with the organization. I mean, there's been the rumors, the whispers about the coaching staff going back to the bubble last year and certainly throughout this year. And now it seems to be once again escalating to the GM's office and maybe even above that. Yeah. It's pretty crazy. There's a lot to dig into. Where do you want to start?
there's so many items. the center of it all, I think, is in the end, the discussion about Jim Benning's job security. And, the fact, like a couple of weeks ago, I thought, you know, when everything was going crazy and whatever that was, the end of January, early February, and we all were like, oh my God. And I was literally like, I said, I think D-Day maybe next week. But I meant in the sense, like, maybe I explained myself. I said, that's when, like, one thing will happen or another. And it ended up, they kind of turned the corner a little bit. And, you know, I certainly do think there were discussions behind the scenes on how to move forward. And obviously the decision, at least at that point, I mean, when Francesco made his tweets.
Famous tweets.
But at that point, it was also like there was a lot of wiggle room in what he had to say there.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I think certainly at that point, there's certainly been tire kicking from the outside. There's no doubt about that. I think there had been some sort of gentle sniffing around of like options, but not, you know, obviously you can't move while everyone's working, really, unless you're doing something like you're actually going to make a move. So I think once he sort of said no plans, you're like, okay, he's leaving he's not shutting the door closed, but he's saying no, like, we're going to wait till the end of the season. So here we are, the end of the season. This someone I actually was messaging with at the time came back to message me about, and this was actually just a fan, but he said, because he had asked me, you know, in February, what do you think? And I had sort of said something, well, I think maybe we're going to wait till the end of the season at this point. And I think this was after Aquilini. And he said, funny how we've come back to this. And I actually completely forgotten the exchange, and I kind of had to laugh because I was like, yeah, you know, in the end, this is actually kind of what we all thought, or at least some of us thought.
Yeah.
But even 2 weeks ago, I mean, obviously they had the Pearson signing, the Demko signings.
Yeah.
And that I think most of us took as being a sign that in many ways Benning was getting his man. But I think in the middle of all this, and I said it the same way, but I think in the middle of all this, we've always kind of maybe missed the point a little bit, which is that we forget the influence of Francesco Aquilini in all this. He has been, I think, far more hands-on than most people realize. You know, certainly, like, I think I posited a while back, here's a guy who's owned his team for 17 years. Like, he's going to think maybe that he knows hockey and has opinions. And certainly all the, you know, sort of discussions I've ever had is that he's long held thoughts on what should happen. And I think that's been increasingly the case over the past decade. And certainly the sort of departure of people plays into that trend line, I would say. And so, you know, his influence plays into all this. So maybe, you know, in the end, maybe it was him that wanted Demko and Pearson, and that's just it. And Jim Benning was just a useful face for the front of it all. I don't know. But, you know, 2 weeks ago, I didn't think we would be sitting where we are today. But certainly things have shifted. It is clear, as I've been saying, that, the tipping point would be the brand. Another tipping point would be literally financial reality. Well, we always knew financial reality was going to be a challenge, but they're intertwined. And if the brand is in trouble, you know, you can project out and say, how is this actually going to, how are finances going to be going forward if people have no faith in the team? And for whatever reason, it sounds like finally started to sink in. And we'll see what happens. But certainly, I mean, it's funny. Yesterday, I did a video with Paul Chapman at Problem Sports. And he asked me, is Jim Benning going to stick around? And, you know, conservatively, I had to say yes. I said yes. But, you know, it was one of those ones. If you have to, it's so difficult to say. And now I hear him a day later. And I think it's probably, I mean, it is kind of what I wrote. I think change are going to happen. I think change is going to happen. Now, is it possible there's some sort of different, like, unanticipated change? You know, does Jim Benning just get shuffled into another role? I mean, I think that's possible. There's no, I'm literally just speculating on that. I don't have any information on that. But, you know, I found myself thinking about that because here's a guy who, in the end, you know, he went to scout the U18s, right? Like, that's what he wants to do in the end. That's his instinct. That's his nature. I think it's one of those cases where anything clearly is possible at this point. I think most people's assumptions are probably right. But then again, when you cover hockey, and certainly when you cover these guys, you learn quite quickly that logic almost rarely applies.
Patrick, do you get the sense that something changed in the last few weeks? Because when I look at this, it seems like the organization has gone particularly quiet over the last few weeks. And I would agree that I got the sense a couple of weeks ago that we would be moving forward with Jim Benning. You touched on the Demko signing, you touched on the Pearson signing. Those would seem like indications from ownership that Jim was their guy. But I agree with you. It feels like something has shifted here. And, you know, is that, how much of that is the fans? How much of that, I know you touched on sort of internal studies and stuff that the ownership group has done in the past, but that, you know, they may be underway with one of those currently.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, I don't think it's a shock that business people would be trying to figure out what they're doing, you know, what's working, what's not. And, you know, it was intimated 2 years ago. Botch was, I remember, on top of this. You know, I was still pretty fresh in it. But yeah, I mean, in the discussions I've had in the 2 years since, it's clear that, yeah, there was a examination of operations and, you know, the process and all that kind of stuff. And you know, I think there were some conclusions reached at that point. And for whatever reason, they decided not to implement them. They kind of carried on with what they were doing. But I think all of our instincts sort of were that 1920, there was sort of a, you know, sort of, it was, a, you know, go, I mean, that's what the Toffoli move was about, right? Like, it was like, you have, like, we sort of said, you know, Benning has to make the playoffs. Like, if he doesn't make the playoffs, I mean, it was obvious. It was an easy analysis at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were in many ways given another year. So, you know, they made the playoffs, and then we're in the middle of a pandemic, which, you know, in fairness, does change so much of your assessment, right? Like, it is, It is in the end going to affect, you know, what costs you're willing to bear. And, you know, we can just see from the actions that there was, in many ways, it wasn't a full on punt on the season. They certainly went and said, well, maybe if this works and this works and that works, we can still sneak into the playoffs while we're really, you know, pulling back on everything else.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a total punt on the year, but it definitely was a strategic. There was an overall process here that said, you know, we're basically, you know, tightening the screws and just seeing how, you know, just getting through this year. And, you know, from a financial standpoint, the hockey making decision making process, I mean, always has been a bit of a mess anyway. So, it's tough to kind of tie that in the same way, because at the end of the day, I mean, Jim Benning, like, you can still look at, you know, it's his team after all, right? But it, you know, and of course, as I said, ownership's been involved, but, you know, the guy in the end, he likes doing two things. I think he likes scouting and he likes making hockey teams. I mean, he may not be very good at it. He may have had a lot of, you know, struggles in that. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt the guy likes picking players together, put them in the mixer and shake them to see what comes out, you know? It's not exactly a modern way of assembling a team.
No.
It's very much, I think, a reflection of how hockey was when he was playing.
Yes.
And, you know, that's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that repeatedly, right? With the signings, the trades, the justifications for moves, the way that he's handled young players, all of that stuff. It's a throwback. What I'm curious, though, about this situation overall, PJ, is, okay, we know the pandemic influence on the finances, and the Canucks have been hit particularly hard. But the kind of more intangible part of this is the brand. This Canucks brand in a city where the other professional sports teams, you know, the two across the street, their brand, even prior to the pandemic, has taken some pretty sizable hits. The Canucks were looking last year like a team that was on the rise and building up from, you know, the ashes of the brand taking some pretty significant hits. And this season, even with all those pandemic qualifiers, seems to have really taken, you know, a pretty big chunk into whatever goodwill might have been built up last year. When they look like the ownership group and I guess some people in upper management, when they are making those decisions, whether it's, you know, roster decisions like Jim Benning is in charge of, or some of the more business decisions like the Aquilini family would be, you know, involved with, how do they view their brand? How do they view themselves within this market in, you know, the modern professional sports phase? That's changed a lot since 2011, the way that people consume this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I was thinking about, it's funny you bring up 2011, because I was thinking a bit about some of the stuff that Benning was trying to do, and sort of it's, somebody just texted me about some off-ice stuff at another team. And I was just thinking about who's involved and who's out there and what people were thinking about and building and all that stuff, like all the off-ice stuff. And how Gills had ideas, but nobody knew how to do that yet, if that makes sense. And now we do. And ironically, there are people involved. Like, there have been hired under Benning. Like, you know, they added, you know, John Wall, added Aiden Fox, they added Ryan Beach, you know, like they do actually have a it's not big, it's not compared to how some other teams are going, but they do have an analytics department and a, you know, a proper sort of video analysis and all that kind of stuff, like actually trying to push the envelope way more, I think, realistically than the Gillis era Canucks had, which is, you know, perhaps ironic, but like I said, it's also things we've learned. And you noted yourself. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not really sure what my point is, but it is a new era, right? And understanding all these things and the sort of the extra 2%, it's those extra 2% things, right? Like the bits and pieces that, you know, the Tampa Bay Rays really put into place as the sort of the Oakland Athletics of the Oakland Athletics, if you will, right? A team that had no money and couldn't afford to do anything. So they made smart investments and tried to find ways to develop players that would play out quickly in ways that, you know, again, Gillis talked about. I mean, they misfired badly in the draft, but the thinking was there. And I think there are people out there now who understand how to understand. I mean, the draft is just so much smarter now for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, you talk to anybody who looks at the draft and, you know, the lessons, there's certainly been lessons taken from, you know, the best drafting sport in the world is the NFL, right? Like the numbers in there is incredible. Pick value is everything in the NFL, right? In hockey, pick value after the first round, you know, actually is pretty even. Like, it's a lot of, everything's a roll of the dice. But the thing is that everyone's doing it. Everyone's thinking in these terms. And if you're not doing it, like, I mean, if you're not maximizing your ability to understand how to sort of work around the edges, you know, that is going to be your great, like that is shooting yourself in the foot. Like, you're falling behind. You can't afford not to think in these terms anymore. And certainly that was, I think, been a failing of Benning's in the big picture, and the inability to plan, you know, as I said, to go back to my analogy of just shaking it all together, getting the shaker out and seeing if you can build a team, you know, you hurt yourself when you think those ways because you end up signing players to three-year contracts who maybe made sense in the time. Like I thought, you know, Sam Gagne was a decent signing, but then to decide a year later that he's not a guy you want anymore, you know, Sven Berchi is the same thing, right? Like Sven Berchi, a year later, they decide, well, we don't want him anymore. And like, how do you make these decisions like that? You know, Michael Ferland, well, maybe it'll work out. You know, like he's dealing with concussion issues. It was a topic from the moment he signed, you know, and they're just like, well, maybe it'll work out. And you can't, it just doesn't work. You can't do that. You can't afford to do that in a salary cap world.
PJ, I wanted to ask you your understanding of what you think is transpiring right now with the Aquilini family as far as their assessment of the organization. But within that, I do want to ask you, we just touched on 2011. You wrote in the Skate this week about the financial impact on the brand, looking back at where this team was 10 years ago versus where they are now. I think it's worth noting that obviously in 2011, they went to a cup final. So there's a lot of playoff revenue there. And obviously we're in a pandemic right now, but it was a fairly significant swing. We're talking about in the ballpark of $100 million, you know, season over season.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard for me not to look and think, you know, when we look at names, there's Lawrence Gilman, who's an assistant GM in Toronto, who, you know, a GM promotion would be appealing to Lawrence. He knows this market. Yeah. He knows this ownership group. And again, I go back to the mastermind of that 2011 group, Mike Gillis, who is in Victoria, who is still there. What's going on with the Aquilinis, and are Lawrence Gilman or Mike Gillis, do you think, in under any consideration for any roles with this ownership group going forward?
It's a really tough read. I think it's a tough read. I think both names, of course, there's obvious reason why there's appeal, and I think both make sense. But the thing with Gillis doesn't need hockey. Let's put it this way. This is how I always put it. Hockey needs Gillis more than Gillis needs hockey. If that makes sense.
Interesting.
And, and certainly the sort of structures that we know have been pitched to other teams don't reflect that he doesn't want to work in hockey. I think he would work in hockey, but on his terms. And, you know, in the end, he's saying, listen, we're not going to run it. We're not going to run it in the sort of old school, he's the GM, he does this, you know, there's going to be much more collaborative. And in many ways, similar to what how it was run here, there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of kind of collective decision-making. You know, in the end, you have a boss and he has to say, he wears it. And I think that's reality. But
do the Aquilinis need Gillis though now? Like,
I think at least somebody that thinks in broad terms and strategic terms and calculated terms. It doesn't have to be Gillis. It has to be someone in of that type though, you know? You also have to recognize that there's a lot of things to keep track of in the modern NHL. I mean, that's why, you know, it was a smart move giving Chris Gear more authority last year because the guy knows contracts. Like he just handles all that stuff. And they, you know, they got into a lot of trouble early on because they were not good with the cap. They've been very aggressive with the cap. And a lot of that's because of Jonathan Wall's understanding of the rules, right? Like there are lots of things that happen now that you need, but you know, that doesn't, you know, you don't need to go hire 7 people to run in your front office, but you need to not have an AGM where people constantly ask, what does he do? Like, is he a scout? Right? Like that's a problem. Like the fact that people ask, what does John Weisbrot do is a problem. Like you can't, it's, you know, in many ways it seems to be a patronage appointment. He's my friend and I want him around. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with having an advisor around, but like, is he the scouting director? If he's the scouting director, then call him that. But you know, it's a very loosely assembled, you know, leadership group, and there's not a lot there. It's two people, basically, you know, Stan Smeal's on the list, but Stan Smeal, as far as I know, is still going to games. But, you know, we've known for a while that, you know, he's not involved in decision making. He hasn't been involved in decision making. As far as I can tell, he's a man without a role. So, you know, each chair at the table needs to have a purpose. And that's certainly a lesson from Gillis, and would be a lesson from Gilman. I mean, yeah, Lawrence Gilman, I think, has done so much, you know, in the game. He's been in AGM. There was a reason that Kyle Dubas hired him when he hired him. You know, he knew that he was worth it. He knew the guy knew, you know, they didn't need a capologist. They had Brandon Pridham already, who used to run Central Registry. You know, he was the guy who would answer the phone.
Right from the inside.
Right? So they brought him over. But, you know, that doesn't mean you don't hire another guy. Like, you know, Gilman knows lots of stuff. And you know, in the end, it's about a sort of a collaborative decision-making process. And I think that's a bit what the Leafs are about as well. So, yeah, I mean, I think that he would be a great fit. I think, you know, in the end, it comes down to the Aquilinis. They know him. How do they feel about him? And, you know, I mean, sure, I don't think it's, I mean, long, you know, a couple of years ago, I mean, when was it, 2 years ago? Yeah, I mean, while this whole review was going, remember Gillis's name bubbled up? And I was like, huh? Yep. I mean, I didn't know as much then as I perhaps know now. I definitely know now. But I had a conversation with someone at that point, not Mike, to be clear. But I had a or Spencer or anybody in the Gillis family. But I talked to someone and I sort of said, what is this noise about? And they said, nothing's impossible. And I was just like, it was stunning. I was just like, huh? So, you know, it's not zero, right? But, you know, it would take a lot of things happening, a lot of shifts at the top. For instance, that were to happen. But you know what? The brand's having a hard time. The team, as you know, Alex, like you said, like revenue's in the tank. And not just because of COVID, right? Like, you know, they just, like, because they haven't been playing playoff games and they haven't been a very good team. Like, that's the problem. They refused to accept the quick rebuild and instead just became this mediocre version of, not even the Minnesota Wild, because at least the Minnesota Wild made the playoffs from time to time. But it's just a directionless team with, you know, contracts that don't make any sense and, you know, put themselves in a real tough spot.
Well, I've sort of said that what makes this situation unique in my eyes, because the Canucks have gone through darker periods, you know, like whether it was the Keenan Messier era that people like to reflect back on or the Willie D era. But what makes this unique to me is that the Canucks have put together on ice, like there's a youthful, decent core here. And yet it's the dysfunction in upper management and at ownership that feels like that's going to jeopardize what could be perceived to be by the fan base a good 10 years here. And that's why I think there's, in my mind, why there's so much focus on upper management and ownership. Really quickly, the name that came up yesterday, and it has been sort of circled, I understand sort of, you know, I heard from a few people after Matt Sakaris reported yesterday, Jeff Courtnell's name. What's your understanding of Jeff Courtnell's role right now as far as it pertains to changes in the organization? Is he just an advisor or is there a chance he may have a role going forward?
I don't even know. I think advisor may overcook it. Like I said, the Courtnell brothers who have, you know, gone into business over the last 20 years and, in various things and varying degrees of success and depending on the venture are friends with the Aquilinis. You know, Roberto Aquilini and Russ Courtnell have homes near each other in Sherman Oaks in California, you know, a very, very swanky part of the world. You know, so I don't think there's a sort of necessarily it's a formal thing, but certainly I think we can see that people are trying to position themselves, you know, to get a slice of the next pie. And so we'll see what happens. I'm not sure necessarily. I don't think we're anywhere close. I mean, we could very well be in a position where, yeah, sure, they are making a list. This is what it's going to look like. This is going to look like, but, you know, I think it is premature to say that Jeff Courtnell is going to be the new president. I actually think it's unlikely. I know Matt Sequeira said there's, you know, that Roberto Aquilini would take over as chairman or whatever. I actually think that's really unlikely. My understanding is that, you know, Roberto wants just to do business. You know, he's a businessman. Yeah. He doesn't want to deal with the hockey team. So I think that's really unlikely. Like I said, you never say never. And logic in this with this team and this the Aquilinis never, you know, you should be careful with it. So I don't know. I think right now, you know, I think a decision has been made. I won't say it's definitely been made until we hear the news, but I get the feeling that, you know, that some kind of change is coming. And like I said, I said on the radio the other day, and I said my skate on Thursday night, I think some kind of change is coming. But I don't have any confidence. I have no confidence in my ability to report right now on anything of what the next thing might look like. But certainly there's, you know, I mean, you hear from people around the league. Like, that's what I said. You know, my phone was very busy the last few days and still is busy. And there was a lot of sort of opinion, a lot of thoughts, and a lot of skepticism too. Mm-hmm. Let's be clear. So we'll see. I don't know. I'll be fair. I've talked to Jeff Courtnell a couple times this season, mostly for other stories. Mm-hmm. You know, he keeps his cards pretty close to the vest, like doesn't necessarily want to, get into stuff like that, but yeah, he acknowledges. Yeah. He knows the Aquilinis. Of course he does. So we'll see. I don't know. It's basically my answer.
Well, one of the factors, PJ, that I find endlessly fascinating, and I think that there's a big Aquilini component to this, but it does predate them in this market, that this market, whether it's the fan base, whether it's the lack of success over 50 years, the names that we are hearing, whether it is Mike Gillis, Lawrence Gilman, Roberto Luongo, you know, the names of the past, the Courtnells, there seems to be this undying attachment to the past in this market for whatever reason. Like, why do you think that is?
I mean, I think some of it comes back to the fact that it's that sort of birthright. Canucks fans learn very young that it's never going to work out, right?
Sure.
Like, they're never going to win. You know, there are those of us that, in like 2011, they're up 2-0 in the final, and there were some of us who went, it's going to happen. It's actually going to happen. And then it didn't, right? Like that was just the confirmation of how it will never be.
Right.
And I think what that in many ways does is it teaches people not to, I mean, some people still look for it. Oh, maybe it'll get better. Maybe this, you know, there's the, and like, you know what, in many ways, as maybe desperate as it may feel to many people, I in a certain level envy those people. Cause like, you know, I talked to season ticket holders this week, and some of them, you know, the people on Twitter are like, they're very much engaged with what's going on, but some of them, well, these are my parents' tickets. They don't, you know, they just like going to the games. They like being there and they enjoy it and they hope maybe they'll win tonight. And I said, I get it. You know, there's a detachment and just sort of ability to be in the moment that is hard to find. You know, when you ask to think critically about the team, like we are, so I think there's some of that is that just people are like, well, you know, there's the hopefuls, right? The forever hopefuls, because they're just like, well, maybe this is it. It's just sports. I'm not going to overthink this. There's those of us who think probably too much about it, but also think about when things were good and how things, you know, things almost were and might have been, you know, and it is a little bit all that sort of, you know, this is what hockey players look to avoid, right? Like they don't want to think too much about the past, and they don't want to worry about, you know, the past. You get, nostalgia is a dangerous place, right? You get lost in nostalgia and, you know, whereas, you know, if you look too far ahead, you start to, you know, you worry about the future and you should just focus on what you're doing in the present. Unfortunately, when it comes to building a hockey team, you can't do that because you need to learn from your mistakes and you need to have a plan going forward. I think in the end, what it comes down to is that it's just that I think some of it's just our wiring. It's just we know it's never going to be good. And so we try to think about the few scraps. It's like why 94 still holds such a strong place in people's hearts, right? Like, I mean, I was 13. I mean, that's, you know, when you're 13 is when your prime sports fandom building years. And, you know, that team was so much fun. But it was out of nowhere. And we forget how, like, that was a really middling season. And then they kind of figured it out in the playoffs. And they were that team that year. And they almost did it against a team that realistically was the heavy favorite. Wasn't a perfect, the Rangers weren't a perfect team either. I mean, 90s hockey is a hard one to assess. But in the end, they have the hot goalie. And, you know, anyway, let's not recount that. But yeah, I think that's a long-winded answer to your very good question.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, PJ, was the Aquilini family dynamic. You touched on Roberto, and I think we have started to hear more about his name. But I would echo your sentiment that I have heard similar things, that while he may have some thoughts and, you know, some of his displeasure with the running of the organization and how it's been perceived this year have led to, you know, maybe a dynamic within the family, I don't think he wants to take over. I think he understands that, you know, he would like to maybe remain in the shadows a little bit more private. But it does sound to me like there's a dynamic taking place right now within the ownership group. Obviously, Francesco is sort of in the middle of that, but there's the father, Luigi, maybe Roberto to a degree, and then Paulo. What's your understanding of the dynamic, and do you sense that there could be a change in the way this family has owned and managed the Canucks at this point going forward?
I don't know. I'm cautious, honestly. Like, you know, you're so reliant on sort of what people tell you and their sort of takes on all of it, and you're trying to sort of synthesize that. And then all you can go on really is action. And, you know, we can look at how the Aquilinis manage their other businesses, you know, and their desire to sort of find value in every corner they can find, maintain costs low, rightly or wrongly. You know, I think avoid ongoing investment. You know, that's something that's become clear. And so in many ways, owning a sports team is a hard one to fit in all that, because owning a sports team does require all those things. And it was interesting to hear what Matt Sakaris had to say yesterday, because he talked a lot about the sort of recognition of how perhaps they've gotten away from ambition and recognizing the price of what sports ambition means. So that will be something for me to watch to see if they get back to where they were, you know, honestly, under Gillis, when they were, you know, they renovated that dressing room and they brought in, you know, a chef for the players, and they talked a lot more about sports science and, you know, the bits around the edges and really what it really means to establish a positive workplace culture. You know, so it'd be interesting to see if they do actually get back in that direction, because, you know, you hear all the players from that era and they all talk about it. They all talk about how Mike was right. You know, Alex Burrow said that to me when I asked him about, you know, his sort of steps as a coach and the stuff that was being put in place then. And a lot of it is pretty familiar. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, a lot of teams do what they were doing now. Like, that's the evolution of sports, is that it's much more player-centered. I mean, I say all the time from my own experience in teaching, like, it's centered. It, you know, education is now student-centered. Well, yeah, coaching is now player-centered. You're trying to help the player become the best player they can be, as opposed to break their will or, you know, force them to do things you believe they should do but don't want to do. And, you know, so a lot of the sort of philosophy and the kind of sort of collaborative decision-making and processes that I think are pretty standard now. I mean, we hear Travis Green's one of these guys, you know. it's emotional intelligence, understanding who your people are and what drives them and how to actually best optimize who they are. None of it seems all that revolutionary, right? But it did for hockey, because hockey was just kind of old school. It ran by old school thinking and old school people. But as we shift into the modern era, where not just so many more people end up going to, post-secondary, but just that basic education is so much more centered on critical thinking and empowers people so much more. Like, it's no surprise that young hockey players, who may not be the best students or whatever, but their basic wiring is very, expects that they will be involved in the process. And, I think all that stuff, in the end, that's what makes it, recognizing and understanding all that stuff is what makes a successful organization. So those will be the things to watch for. How do they actually, they have to build a minor league team, right? I mean, if they really are going to overhaul the whole place, as Matt is suggesting, and I think there's a very good chance of that. I think a large portion of what Matt reported yesterday was pretty spot on, because it's a lot of stuff I've been arguing for. I think I said those are the things to be watching for and see how things play out over the next weeks.
On the ice this year, I think the things that we thought would go wrong went wrong probably even more spectacularly than people could have anticipated. Depth on the blue line, the famous or infamous bottom six. There were some positive stories throughout the year. Nils Höglander putting together a really strong rookie season. Brock Besser rediscovering his scoring touch. It's tough to expect the team to compete when their elite center is not playing for half the season, et cetera, et cetera. Beyond sort of the obvious stuff of too much money in the bottom six, not enough production, the real questions about the middle of that defense and, do they have enough guys that can play heavy minutes and do so effectively? What stands out to you as sort of something that maybe surprised you as a positive this year and something that surprised you as a negative, where you think there's maybe more reason for concern outside of the really obvious ones that we know?
Well, I'll start with the negative. I mean, the team's difficulty defending remains a concern for me. Last year's success, such as it was built on the backs of, admittedly amazing performances by your goalie. In certain level, encouraging a certain type of high danger shot against. But, in the end, the best teams just don't give up that many chances. So that to me is a thing that remains a big concern. And, I think there's an intersection mostly about personnel, and that's mostly on management. To some degree, perhaps it's about some choices that Travis Green makes, but on the whole, I think he makes the best with what he has.
Right.
I think the positives are, Nils Höglander is an obvious, easy one. There's been a few, the fact that we've seen some of the young kids play, that Thatcher Demko appears to be a promising, it really is a promising player of the future, not just the flash in the pan that he was in the bubble. I would say that such as it is, the young players that are there. And then, as a sort of a side note, that Vasily Podkolzin really looks like he's going to be a player. Not that I think necessarily we ever had any doubt, but he's really cemented that this year. I sort of take that sort of that youthful, the actual truth. It's not a ton of it, and there's not exactly a lot of guys lining up out the door that really are going to make an impact. Like Jonah Gadjevich, sure, might score a few goals, but let's be honest, the guy, he's a flawed player. Will Lockwood's a flawed player. Like these are not guys that tell you that they're going to become second and third. Like Cole Lynn played, didn't embarrass himself, but he didn't score. You never went, wow, Cole Lynn needs to play more, maybe that happens next year, but the truth is in the end, there's a lot of sort of, okay, he could play as a fourth liner. That's fine. That saves you money. You don't have, you know, in the end, it's a reminder, mm-hmm. you don't need to spend all this money on your fourth line. But that's not how you, that's not how you build a winning team. But yeah, the fact that, you know, that Jack Rathbone is going to clearly be an NHL player, and Vasily Podkolzin is going to be an NHL player, and the, you know, Thatcher, like I said, Thatcher Demko basically having a really good year other than his shaky start and perhaps his not great February. I think that would be my positive.
Yeah, there's definitely some silver linings on the ice when you look at the core that they've been able to build. There's obviously some changes to make. Last one, PJ, before we get you out of here. There's been a lot of talk about Travis Green. I think that's sort of been pushed into the background over the last couple of days as news of a bigger reorganization change has happened here. I guess my question is there less of a chance that Travis Green returns? It feels like he's the innocent bystander here in a drive-by shooting as, yeah. like, you know, ownership tries to sort out. You know, where does Travis fall in all of this? And is he going to be sort of an innocent casualty, to put it
mildly? That's such a great analogy. I mean, yeah, I think in the end, you know, a guy that has been doing his best in circumstances, you know, nothing as I understand it about whatever negotiations have taken place. And they certainly haven't been any discussions in weeks, if not months. Have not been centered on him making unreasonable demands or anything like that. And certainly the language Jim Benning has used more than once has made it clear that this is something he would like to do. And so there's a third party involved, which is the man who signs the checks. And however much he believes a coach is worth. And, you know, I think in the end, anything could change. Sure. You know, maybe this is just all holding patterns saying, let's be honest. It's happened twice to one player in the last 12 months where they've been told, can you wait? We need to make some decisions. You know, Nikita Tramkin was told mm-hmm. this, his agents were told this twice. So maybe it's the same rationale. Travis, can you wait? We just want to see what we're going to do at the top. You know, I my impression is, you know, I talked to Travis recently often. My impression with Travis is that he's liked it. I mean, this is the team that gave him his chance in the NHL. That means something. But he's an ambitious guy. And, you know, he, in the end, this is the hardest thing. This is the hardest thing we all will ever have to run into. At some point, you have to look out for number one. You have to make the best decision that for you financially that you can make. And you can't hold on to hope for too long, because at some point there are no chairs left. So, yeah, I think, like I said, never say never. It could work out. There could be a change, but at this point, I think it will take a lot for something to happen that sees him stay.
Well, I saw this morning that he said he's concentrating on the next four games of this season. I think that's maybe not true for the entire fan base at this point with the playoffs starting.
Just to be clear, I was on the call and it was IMAC tried. IMAC being a good reporter.
Yeah,
no, sure. Travis, I'm not going to ask you about your contract. I know you don't want to talk about it, but can we say anything about your assistance and you know the impacts of all this on them? And Travis is just like, he said, I understand why the media wants to talk about it and ask questions, but he said, no, we're concentrating on the games. And I mean, Travis is never one who wants to speak for anybody. You know, I think he understands the position he's in. But he didn't want to comment. So that's what that was. But yeah, I mean, he's been asked about it. He doesn't want to get in. I mean, he spoke, I think what he said Tuesday and Thursday about sort of the lineup and the roster and his own sort of situation mm-hmm. is, I think, the most we'll get, at least at this point.
Until next week.
Maybe that changes on Thursday or Friday or whatever it is that we end up doing media. So.
Oh, well, big dark games for the Canucks night. Coming up, man. Big games. Oh, enjoy them.
Like Thatcher Demko, thankfully I only have to deal with two of them.
That's right. PJ, awesome. Thanks for the time, man. Great to catch up with you, and look forward to following your work and what seems to be going to be a very intriguing offseason.
You're listening to the On Air podcast with Israel Fair and Alex Blair.